Ink and Paint wishes to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people, the traditional owners of the land on which this podcast is recorded and edited. It is a great privilege to be able to tell stories on this land, which has a tradition of storytelling stretching back over 10,000 years. We also wish to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands from all over the world where our guests record from. We pay our respects to all elders past, present, and emerging, and to our First Nations listeners.
Well, we're gonna get more money,
cause we know that we're funny. We're gonna hit the big bucks for a raise.
Hello, and welcome to Ink and Paint Inbetweeners, our series of bonus episodes expanding on the story of the Disney animated classics. I'm your host, Daniel Lemon. In these short bonuses, we're sharing history and stories related to the Disney animated classics that sit just outside of the films themselves and complement our main Ink and Paint episodes. In this in-betweener, we're looking at one of the most important events in the history of the company and the unusual film that was released in the midst of it. On June 20th, 1941, RKO Pictures released The Reluctant Dragon, a new feature film from Walt Disney Productions. Mostly forgotten today except by Disney enthusiasts, it was essentially a tour through the many departments of the new studios at Burbank, interspersed with original animated sequences. It presented a picture of the Disney studios as a kind of animation utopia, with professional facilities and smiling staff engaged in rigorous and thrilling artistic enterprises. Like the fully animated features, though, The Reluctant Dragon was a fantasy. In truth, Walt Disney Productions was in a state of chaos, engaged in a very public and increasingly ugly union dispute that would permanently alter the structure and atmosphere of the revered animation studio and prey on the worst tendencies of its beloved creator. When the staff moved from the Hyperion Studios to the new facility at Burbank, Walt Disney saw it as a necessary move for the company. The design of the campus had been supervised by Disney himself, making sure that every detail met his very specific demands. Development of the facilities at Hyperion had occurred when necessary and had outgrown the site, extending to apartment buildings all over the neighborhood. The Burbank studio centralized operations with state-of-the-art buildings for each department designed specifically to their needs. This included new camera facilities, sound stages, and rooms for the animators with purpose-built animation desks. Disney had even gone as far as having grass planted all over the studio to catch as much dust from the air as possible. Recreation areas were also taken into consideration, including a cafeteria and a gymnasium. Disney wanted his staff to want for nothing, but also wanted to streamline the filmmaking process as much as possible. The new facilities meant a restructure of the various departments. Rather than artists being able to oversee work between departments, they now worked in units, supervised by a control desk that monitored the movements of work between departments. The studio now employed well over 1,000 staff, and this necessitated a clearer company structure and hierarchy. Almost as soon as the move to Burbank was completed, the staff began expressing concern. The new studio did not have the camaraderie or the easy freedom and expression of ideas that Hyperion had. In fact, many felt that the restructuring hindered it. They felt isolated from one another and from Disney himself. Where the boss had once been a constant presence, he now spent large portions of his day in his office, with a private bathroom, bedroom, and team of secretaries. After Snow White and the Seven Dwarves, Disney made sure that his staff shared in the financial success. They were given healthy bonuses and paid vacations, and the offer of low-interest loans from the studio. The failure of Pinocchio and Fantasia, though, put the company back under financial pressure. By the beginning of 1941, stock prices had dropped from $25 to as low as $4, and rumors started to spread that Disney was planning to lay off staff and promote cheaper and less experienced animators, including women, to higher-ranking animation jobs. The company going public in April 1940 also meant that Disney's salary was made public, revealing that he was paid 5 times more a week than some of the senior creative staff, and 100 times more than the women in Ink and Paint. There was also preferential treatment with the privileges Disney had so proudly bestowed on his staff. Most of them were reserved for the top animators, including access to nicer facilities and workspaces, and there was talk of favoritism. Most employees did not earn enough to be able to afford the food in the cafeteria. In one incident, a woman in the Ink and Paint department fainted from malnutrition. Her husband had left her during the Depression, and she was skipping lunch on a regular basis to save her $6 a week salary to feed her children. There were also consequences for breaking rank. When animator Don Lusk began helping lower-ranking animators by taking on extra cleanup and in-betweener work, he was stripped of his office furnishings, left only with his animation desk and chair. Walt Disney didn't believe, though, that anything was wrong. He had purpose-built the studio for his staff, and in his mind, the spirit of invention and inspiration at Hyperion had carried over. He was about to discover just how wrong he was. The National Labor Relations Act of 1935 secured the rights for workers in the US to unionize, and very quickly, workers in Hollywood began to organize themselves into guilds. Most of the studio bosses fought against their establishment, but the movement had grown so strong that they had no choice but to comply. By the beginning of 1941, animators had rallied around two union organizations, the Independent Federation of Screen Cartoonists and the more robust Screen Cartoonists Guild. Under the leadership of labor tactician Herbert Sorrell, the guild had effectively unionized all of the animation studios except for Walt Disney Productions. These other companies only equated to around 150 members, though, while Disney represented more than half of the animators working in the US. For the guild to have any standing, they needed the Disney staff. Among the more vocal supporters of unionism at the studio was legendary animator Art Babbitt. He had joined the studio in the 1930s and become one of the most powerful creative forces in the animation department. He was also outspoken and was constantly in opposition with Disney. Babbitt expressed concern that, while he was being paid $300 a week, his assistants were being paid only $50 a week. He was one of the first high-ranking Disney employees to join the guild. Sorrell approached Disney and tried to convince him to sign with the guild, claiming that most of the animators at the studio already had. Disney didn't believe him, and wanted it put to a ballot through the National Labor Relations Board. Sorrell refused, having recently lost such a ballot. There had been some unionism at the studio, with Disney operating closed shop agreements with staff such as musicians and electricians, but he couldn't see why the rest of the staff would want to unionize. He wasn't like the other studio bosses, had happily given them everything they wanted. Disney decided that the best course of action would be to address the staff himself. In February 1940, he gathered the 1,200 employees in the largest auditorium and spoke to them from a 26-page pre-prepared statement, which was recorded and transcribed. In it, he talked about the success and challenges of the studio and explained his reasonings behind many of his decisions. He spoke from the heart, just as he had always done, convinced it would settle all problems and bring the studio back to harmony. In the 20 years I've spent in this business, I've weathered many storms. It's been far from easy sailing. It required a great deal of work, struggle, determination, competence, faith, and above all, unselfishness. Some people think we have a class distinction in this place. They wonder why some people get better seats at the theatre than others. They wonder why some men get spaces in the parking lot and others don't. I have always felt and always will feel that the men that contribute most to the organisation should, out of respect alone, enjoy some privileges. My first recommendation to the lot of you is this. Put your own house in order. You can't accomplish a damn thing by sitting around and waiting to be told everything. If you're not progressing as you should, instead of grumbling and growling, do something about it. This business is ready to go ahead. If you want to go ahead with it, you've got to be ready for some hard work. If the business is to survive the many storms that are ahead of it, it must be made strong, and that strength comes from the individual strength of the employees. Don't forget this. It's the law of the universe that the strong shall survive, and the weak must fall by the way. And I don't give a damn what idealistic plan is cooked up, nothing can change that. The response from the staff was far from positive. Many felt even more frustrated by the situation, and one left-wing magazine claimed that Disney's speech had done more to recruit Disney animators to the guild than a year of campaigning. Rather than calming down the situation, his speech further fanned the flames. The Reluctant Dragon was built as a vehicle for American humorist and film personality Robert Benchley, who won an Oscar for his comic series of How To Shorts. In the film, Benchley is pressured by his wife, Nana Bryant, into visiting the Burbank studio and pitching Walt Disney the idea of adapting Kenneth Graham's 1898 short story, The Reluctant Dragon. The film begins in black and white, with Benchley avoiding an overzealous errand boy by exploring the many departments of the studio, including art classes, recording studio, and sound effects department. When he finds the camera department and the multiplane camera, the film transitions into Technicolor, and he continues his journey through the character model department, ink and paint, and animation, collecting souvenirs along the way, before finding Disney in a screening room. Walt invites him to watch their latest short, which turns out to be The Reluctant Dragon. The film was budgeted at $600,000, intended to turn an easy profit. Disney was banking on his own personality, as well as continued requests from the public to know how an animated film was made. Live action was significantly cheaper than animation, but apart from the title short, the film also featured a goofy cartoon and an ingenious sequence outlining a story called Baby Weems, told entirely in enhanced storyboards. Benchley's tour also revealed behind-the-scenes progress on Dumbo in the sound department and Bambi in the ink and paint department, and introduced him to a number of prominent Disney legends, including Greta Scott, Frank Churchill, and Fred Moore. A number of professional actors were also brought on to play Disney staff, including a young Alan Ladd. While the title short is easily the most famous aspect of The Reluctant Dragon, released separately on VHS and DVD, the film itself is a surprisingly fascinating and thorough look at the animation process. It has the benefit of a clear objective and following it, so that the film never tries to be more than what it is. There are some terrific moments, such as a duet between voice artists Clarence Nash and Florence Gill as Donald Duck and Clara Duck respectively, and a strong demonstration of the multiplane camera process. Today, the film is mostly forgotten by the general public, appealing mostly to Disney and animation enthusiasts. But at the time, Disney hoped the film would turn a tidy profit. In a way, it depicts the fantasy version of the studio that Disney wanted to promote, full of calm and smiling faces, none expressing concern or exhaustion. In reality, the whole studio was about to collapse.
I understand you got some kind of a story idea, Bob.
Oh, well, no, it's my wife had an idea. I've got it here, some sort of a book. You want to have this?
Art Babbitt's vocal criticism of Walt Disney intensified following the February speech, and Disney felt personally betrayed by Babbitt joining the Guild. On May 28, 1941, Disney dismissed Babbitt and 16 other employees who were also Guild members. Herbert Sorrell called for a strike, and that night, the Guild members voted 315-15 in favour. At 6 a.m. on Monday the 29th, 293 employees of Walt Disney Productions formed a picket line outside the studio gates. When Disney arrived, he was met by angry employees holding signs with slogans such as "Are we mice or men?" and "I've got a bone to pick with Walt." One placard even depicted Walt as a dragon with the word "unfair" painted on him and the sign "The Reluctant Disney." Babbitt led the charge with the support of Sorrell and a number of prominent staff, including Bill Tytler, joining the picket line out of solidarity for their colleagues. The problem was, the studio was still finishing work on Dumbo and about to ramp up on Bambi. 60% of employees crossed the picket line, and it now rested on them to complete the films. The afternoon before the strike, Disney spoke personally to the women in ink and paint, asking for their support. Most of them continued to work, taking on the enormous task of inking and painting Dumbo in record time. By the end of June, Disney was still refusing to acknowledge the Guild or negotiate with Sorrell, who intensified his public attacks on Disney, and even organized a secondary strike from workers at Technicolor. When The Reluctant Dragon opened on June 20th, strikers picketed the premiere and many theaters where the film was shown. Tensions began to intensify on both sides, with constant verbal abuse and threats of violence. Employees who crossed the picket line spoke of their cars being damaged and friendships breaking down, and in one incident, someone circled the picketers with a ring of gasoline and threatened to set them alight. One morning, when Babbitt saw Disney driving into the studio, he grabbed a bullhorn and began hurling abuse at him. Disney stopped the car and leapt at Babbitt, the studio guards having to hold the two men back from attacking one another. Disney became convinced that the only explanation for his staff turning on him was a wider conspiracy. Many of the studio bosses in Hollywood blamed communism for the rise in unionism, and Disney felt no different. On July 2nd, he published a full-page advertisement in Variety expressing these concerns, addressed to the employees on strike. He also had photographs taken of the picket line and studied the faces of the crowd intensely. When he spoke before the California Un-American Activities Committee in 1947, he said that he had not recognized half the faces in the crowd, and had been told by investigators for HUAC that many of the men followed Sorrell from strike to bolster the crowds. To quell Walt's tempestuous behaviour, Roy took charge of coming to an agreement with the strikers. On July 28th, a deal was announced, but to be able to financially meet the demands, Roy announced that there would need to be layoffs. The union protested, so Roy decided that the best course of action would be to shut down production at the studio until a final agreement could be reached. Early in 1941, the studio had been approached by the US government to participate in a cultural exchange with South America as part of Roosevelt's Good Neighbor policy, an attempt to counteract the growing relationships between Nazi Germany and many Latin American countries. In August, with Roy's encouragement, Walt decided to take the opportunity to escape the chaos at home and lead a group of his staff on a fact-finding tour with the intention of developing new films on Latin American culture. Roy was left to clean up the mess of the strike. During this trip, their father, Elias Disney, passed away, but Walt chose not to return for his father's funeral. Roy was supportive of this, determined to keep his tempestuous brother away until an agreement had been reached. 5 weeks after the strike had begun, during which time both The Reluctant Dragon and Dumbo were released, an agreement was finally reached, giving the strikers almost everything they had wanted, and the studio reopened on September the 21st. Walt was absent for the settlement, wanting to forego the embarrassment. As a result of the agreement, significant layoffs were necessary, but part of the deal was that only half could be employees involved in the strike. Nearly half of the staff at Walt Disney Productions were let go, including Tyrus Wong, Retta Scott, and Sylvia Holland. And with barely 600 employees left, the company went through a significant restructuring. Babbitt and many of the strikers were allowed to return to the studio, but the culture had changed. Divisions between friends and colleagues still existed, and Disney became even more distant and untrusting of his staff. He kept a file with the names of the strikers, saying that one day they would no longer work at the studio. Within 2 years, many of them would leave of their own accord, including Art Babbitt and Bill Tytler. Three of them, Stephen Bisesto, David Hilberman, and John Hubley, left to form their own animation studio, United Productions of America, which would soon become a major artistic rival for Disney. Walt Disney emerged from the strike an embittered man. He saw the actions of his staff as a personal attack, and while he encouraged all his staff to join their respective unions so as to avoid future trouble, he had nothing but contempt for unionism. It would be the fuel of his attacks against communism during his testimonies for the House and American activities in 1947. As for The Reluctant Dragon, it was not the financial savior Disney had hoped. It was met with warm reviews, especially for the title short, but most critics admitted it was little more than a commercial for the studio. The film did make a profit, but far from a substantial one, just over $350,000. Audiences had expected a film in the vein of Snow White or Pinocchio, and were turned off by this pseudo-documentary style. While the short became popular on its own, the full film remained mostly unseen except for exclusive VHS and DVD releases through the Disney Store and Disney Movie Club. It was released on Blu-ray though as an extra on the double feature disc of The Adventures of Ichabod and Mr. Toad and Fun and Fancy 3 in 2014, and is now available on Disney Plus. With the strike now resolved, work could recommence at Walt Disney Productions. Dumbo had offered them a momentary financial respite, but in December 1941, the US entered the Second World War, and the studio Walt Disney had so carefully designed was commandeered as an army base. The downsized staff were now gearing up to produce training and propaganda films for the war effort, as well as bringing the gargantuan production of Bambi to completion. For better or worse though, Walt Disney Productions had been fundamentally altered by the strike in May 1941. The fantasy of an animation utopia was coming to an end. Thanks for listening to this in-between a bonus episode. Be sure to check out the show notes in this week's episode at inkandpaint.com.au for more information about the Disney strike and The Reluctant Dragon, including artwork and archival photos. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the podcast. Hit us up with your comments, questions, or even memories of your favourite Disney films, and we'll be sure to share them on our upcoming episodes. You can email Daniel at inkandpaint.com.au or find me on Twitter at Daniel Lemon. We'll be releasing new in-betweeners as we go along, so make sure to subscribe to Ink and Paint on your favourite podcasting platform to make sure you don't miss any. And if you enjoyed the episode, remember to rate and review and to tell your friends about us. Ink and Paint in-betweeners are created, hosted and written by myself, Daniel Lemon, and produced and edited by Alex Amster. Original music is composed by Sam Porter. The show artwork is designed by Nicholas Piranakis, and the podcast is released through Switch. MakeTheSwitch.com.au. Join in next time on Ink and Paint to continue our journey through the Disney animated classics.